and red parts of sunlight, letting you concentrate on the yellow colors that are easier to focus. Without blue and red, everything seems sharper. This moment of science comes from Indiana University with production support from the Brabson Foundation. Today's program was prepared by Eric Sonstrom with help from Larry Thibos in optometry. I'm Don Glass.
In sports, two top 25 men's basketball teams will be in the Chicago area tonight. Number 17, Butler, takes on Loyola of Chicago, while number 19, Purdue, faces Northwestern in Evanston. In other college basketball action, the University of Illinois Chicago hosts Valparaiso. Western Illinois takes on Centenary, and Eastern Illinois faces Eastern Kentucky. The Fighting Illini women will try to bounce back from Monday's loss to Ohio State when Iowa comes to town for a game tonight at Assembly Hall. Illinois is trying to right the ship after seven straight losses. The Illinois men turned the tables on number 25 Michigan last night after losing in Ann Arbor 10 days earlier. The Illini beat the Wolverines 66-51 at the Assembly Hall. In that earlier matchup, Coach Bruce Weber pulled center Mike Tisdale from the game early, saying Tisdale was too rattled by Michigan forward Deshaun Sims to be effective. But Tisdale led all scorers last night with 24 points. Afterwards, he said the whole team played with much more spirit in the rematch.
Up in Michigan, it wasn't that great a game. And, you know, we felt that we should have won. But we didn't play well. We didn't play very hard. And I think everybody's attitude this game was, you know, don't matter what, win or lose, we got to play hard. And, you know, I think that made a big difference.
Guard Dimitri McKamey added 17 points for Illinois. The Illini won their 1,600th all-time victory last night. The Illini are now 3-1 in the Big Ten. They travel to East Lansing next to play Michigan State on Saturday afternoon. The Cleveland Cavaliers are in Chicago tonight, visiting the Bulls at the United Center. And the St. Louis Blues could be without all-star Keith Tkachuk tonight when they host the Colorado Avalanche. Tkachuk, a left wing, went down after apparently hurting his jaw late in the second period Tuesday. He's uncertain for tonight's game. That's sports.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery at 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign, offering guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of all sizes made of pure wool or silk pile, designed to add beauty to any decor, whether homes or offices.
It's 2:43. Overseas, even in normally robust Germany, the recession is accelerating at an alarming rate. This week, the government there unveiled an economic stimulus package worth nearly $70 billion. From Berlin, Thomas Martzall reports.
For months, Germany was accused of not doing enough to revive its ailing economy. Conservative Chancellor Angela Merkel even earned the nickname Madam No. Her coalition of social democrats and conservatives thought a limited stimulus they passed back in November would be sufficient. But Madam No is no more. On Wednesday, she defended a new stimulus package, including billions of euros for roads and schools and tax cuts and incentives for consumers.
Wir wollen diese Krise nicht einfach überstehen.
Germany should not just survive this crisis, Merkel told the country's lower house of parliament. The stimulus would help it emerge stronger with a more secure economic future. Analysts say the collapse of the global economy woke up the government because it eventually led to Germany. Exports of the country's vaunted cars and machine tools are plunging, and last month, unemployment also edged up for the first time in years. While the financial industry has not hemorrhaged money like in the U.S., Germany's biggest bank, Deutsche Bank, just announced it lost $5 billion in 2008. Critics are warning of dangerously higher deficits and dismissed the tax cuts as insignificant. One opposition politician scoffed that low-income Germans would gain about $4 a month, barely the cost of a bratwurst. For NPR News, I'm Thomas Martzall in Berlin.
It's not just the guns in Kabul that are dangerous, it's also the air. In the freezing winters, many residents in Afghanistan's mile-high capital burn plastic and tires for warmth. Those lucky enough to own a car use leaded fuel. And then there are thousands of gas-burning generators in shops and homes across the city to provide power that the government cannot. Air pollution in Kabul is so bad that President Hamid Karzai has declared an emergency. NPR correspondent Soraya Sahardi-Nelson lives in Kabul and has the story.
Experts say Kabul is rapidly becoming one of the world's worst cities for air pollution. And nowhere is it more polluted than in this neighborhood near President Karzai's compound. Here, the rancid air casts a yellow haze. Pedestrians hurry past, pressing scarves to their faces. Several American Humvees roll past Mahbubullah Bakhtiari, who is setting up a cylindrical device. He works for Afghanistan's Environmental Protection Agency and is here to measure just how bad the air is.
We put filter in air.
Bakhtiari places white filters into the monitor.
And then we tight it. Now it's ready.
He says it will take less than a day for those filters to turn black.
Do you wear a mask yourself here, knowing how bad the air is?
No.
Why not?
Because if we wear masks, people will laugh on us.
They will laugh at you.
Yeah.
But he and others here say the smog is no laughing matter. Darullah Mansouri is the chief of staff at the Afghan EPA.
The air pollution that we are facing currently in Afghanistan, in Kabul, if such pollution exists anywhere else in the world, there will be no schools open, no shops, no government agencies will be able to function. Because this is 7 times worse than the standards.
And the problem is growing. Experts say there are many reasons why, such as 5 million people living in a city designed for 500,000. Most of them burn wood, coal, and trash to keep warm during the cold winters. Raw sewage and dust add to the smog, as do factories that spew unfiltered smoke. There are also 10 times as many cars on the streets now than during the Taliban era. Most are foreign cast-offs that run on leaded fuel. The result of all this smog is seen in hospitals across Kabul. Doctors say residents flock to them with lung and heart ailments, as well as cancers. Muhammad Iqlil Niazi is a doctor at Ali Abad Hospital. He says 4 years ago, 1 in 5 patients had an ailment triggered by air pollution. Now he estimates 1 in 3 is sick from the smog. Like 55-year-old Muhammad Ismail, the frail shopkeeper who doesn't smoke, suffers from a chronic lung disease his doctors say is caused by air pollution. He's come to the hospital for drugs to ease his cough. His doctors say the only real remedy is for him to leave Kabul. That's what Mansouri did. The Afghan EPA official moved to a nearby town. He says he'd rather risk attacks by militants during his commute to Kabul than let his kids breathe the air here. Yet few in the government besides Mansouri have paid attention to air pollution.
Something is definite that previously environment was not priority for this government. Security, defense, other issues were priority.
Mansouri's agency was given no teeth and little money when it was established 3 years ago. Even now, there are few environmental laws on the books, none of which are enforced because of rampant bribe-taking. At a recent cabinet meeting, President Karzai declared such inaction must end, and quickly. Mansouri, who was there, says Karzai authorized $100 million to buy equipment to reduce air pollution in Kabul. He formed an emergency committee with far-reaching powers to tackle the problem. Mansouri says the president also ordered that bushes be handed out to residents for planting to help absorb the toxins.
Now I think the cabinet members and the president himself, they came to know that if you don't have safe environment, clean environment, you never have safe economic development and sound social development.
But Mansouri says that doesn't change the fact it will take years to reduce smog here. Soraya Sahardi-Nelson, NPR News, Kabul.
There's been plenty of buzz about dozens of proposed nuclear power reactors in the U.S. Wall Street's financial mess is making power companies scramble to find all the investment money for them. But in 12 states, it won't matter whether power companies have cash in hand or not. It's illegal to build new nuclear power plants there. Sean Ali reports there are efforts to repeal some of those bans.
Joanne Osman represents a state legislative district in northeastern Illinois. Nuclear power is close to her heart. There's an old, dormant nuclear power plant right in her district. Osman thought maybe that plant could be useful again, so she sat down with the plant owner
And I asked a question, you know, why are you not taking some of the parts and putting them in other nuclear locations? And they said, well, there's a moratorium. We're not building any more nuclear plants in the state of Illinois.
Osmond was stunned. Illinois has 6 existing nuclear power plants. She didn't know it's illegal to build more. She hears plenty of gripes about energy prices, so she thought, why leave nuclear energy off the table?
I don't want my granddaughters to have to buy their electricity from another state. I want to be able, in 2020, 2030, to be able to plug in our electric cars.
Osmond's bill to lift the moratorium stalled. It's still illegal to build nuclear power plants in Illinois. California and Wisconsin recently had similar fights over their nuclear moratoria. Some veterans of nuclear politics are shocked anyone would want to lift a ban on nuclear power plants.
It makes absolutely no logical, rational sense in any mode of analysis.
I find Dave Kraft at a coffee shop. Kraft is with the Nuclear Energy Information Service, a group that's worked against nuclear power for almost 30 years. 12 states severely restrict or ban new nuclear power plants. Kraft says 7 have language almost identical to Illinois'.
The moratorium simply said, no more new construction of nuclear reactors until the federal government has a demonstrated means of dealing with the waste permanently.
Kraft says states tried protecting themselves from becoming dumps for the most dangerous nuclear waste, the radioactive spent fuel. The federal government is supposed to store spent fuel, maybe in Yucca Mountain, Nevada. But so far, that hasn't happened, so it's piling up in nuclear power plants, like this one in Braidwood, Illinois, southwest of Chicago. Brian Hansen manages the Braidwood power plant. He leads me to a square storage pool. It has the bluest water I've ever seen.
This is where we store our spent fuel. I mean, it's about 30 feet of water between us and the top of the fuel bundles down there. So you're looking at 30 feet in the water, and then again another 12 feet down below.
If you look into it, it's almost like honeycomb.
Honeycomb. It looks just like an egg crate or honeycomb. Within those cells are fuel bundles that have been, you know, used in the reactor, generated energy, and now they're waiting here for eventual disposal.
Braidwood's pool was meant for short-term storage, but spent fuel has been stored here for 19 years. Hansen says the company is planning for when spent fuel will have to be stored on-site, but outdoors, perhaps for decades. It's a situation the nuclear industry is unhappy about, but it's confident the federal government will come up with a solution someday. So most power companies support removing bans on new plants. This drives critics like Dave Kraft crazy.
To build more reactors at a time when we have absolutely no place to put the waste makes no sense at all. First rule of waste management is stop producing.
Even though Kraft says it does not make sense to lift bans on nuclear power plant construction, he predicts those bans will get challenged again soon. For the Environment Report, I'm Sean Aldi.
This in from the Associated Press, a U.S. Airways plane has crashed into the Hudson River in New York. Boats are rescuing passengers. That's all we have at this moment. We'll bring you the latest as it becomes available. You might have noticed some new choices for environmentally friendly cleaners on supermarket shelves. Most people pass them over. They worry natural cleaners won't do the job as well as regular cleaners. But the places that need to be the cleanest are finding that green cleaners are more effective. Julie Grant reports that hospitals have started replacing old chemical cleaners with natural products.
It used to stink whenever the cleaning guys at the Cleveland Clinic needed to strip the floors. The patients, doctors, and nurses would complain about the chemical vapors, so they started clearing areas of the hospital on floor cleaning days. Today, Dennis Casey says they drive around on a new scrubbing machine.
That's an automatic stripper. It's called an orbital scrubber, and it strips the floors without the use of chemicals, only water.
The newfangled machine looks kind of like a riding mower. They run over the hospital floors, spraying cold water, and the machine scrubs. Casey says it works just as well as the old chemicals, but it doesn't smell and it takes a lot less time. That's music to Christina Ayers' ears. She's environmental coordinator at the Cleveland Clinic. Ayers says the most important part of picking cleaners and tools is to make sure they're going to work. Of course, water alone isn't enough for every job. Hospitals need disinfectants. Ayers says the Environmental Protection Agency helps with that.
EPA actually certifies disinfectants, and all products that are used as a disinfectant have to go through the same rigorous testing to ensure their efficacy. But what we're buying when we're buying the products is the efficacy of the product, not all the additional chemicals and perfumes and other elements that are not necessary for the product to function well.
Ayres says lots of people are used to that hospital smell, but that's often just a cocktail of cleaning chemicals, and it doesn't create the healthiest environment for patients and staff. They still use bleach at the clinic. It's a great disinfectant, but only in specific places, door handles and other high-traffic areas. Ayres says other places, like windows and bathrooms, can get just as clean without other harsh chemicals. At first, it was tough for some folks on the cleaning staff to accept the new fragrance-free products. Those strong smells signaled a clean room. Ayres says some would use the natural cleaners, but then spray chemical air fresheners just to make sure the room smelled clean.
Well, that's a bridge we have to cross. We have to help people understand that clean smells of nothing, and that when you're smelling all of those smells that are associated with clean, that chemical smell, smell of bleach, those perfumes, all those volatile organic compounds that come out of those cleaning products, that's really, you don't really want to be inhaling all of that product. You really want it to be working. You want to purchase the efficacy of the product and not all that extra stuff that goes into our air.
Ayres says people with asthma and other breathing problems understand that right away, and often others just need a little explanation.
Once you explain that to people, that you're using a product that's safer for the indoor air quality of our hospital, it's an easy step. People understand it, and they quickly go accustomed to the new smell of clean, which is a much more mild and fresh and less chemical smell than what you might be familiar with even in your own home.
In fact, I talked with one woman on the cleaning staff who says since the hospital switched to more natural products, she's seen how well they work and has started using green cleaners at home. For the Environment Report, I'm Julie Grant.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Park Foundation, the George Gunn Foundation, and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can find more information and share your thoughts at environmentreport.org.
Earth and Sky.
You know, I think you do see kids who are inclined towards the sciences, and these are the why, you know, why kids. Why is that? And you say, because. And then there's, of course, there's another why.
That's Ursula DeMarco, who was herself a why kid. Today she's an astronomer at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. She talked with Earth and Sky about her childhood.
Another, you know, thing that happened to me at a very early age is, of course, you get asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? But very, very early, I said to my parents that I wanted to be an academic. And my mother almost passed out.
There were other clues about her future as a scientist. DeMarco would test the laws of physics, dropping stuffed animals out of her windows to see if parachutes she had constructed made of plastic bags would work.